Our world had been torturing and killing our people for 2 long years, unchecked. In the periphery of my vision, I could see the Nine flashing their way toward Winterborn, leaving slaughtered Fae in their wake. She was precisely who we needed to kill, to buy time before another princess would be born, and I knew what Riordan was thinking. Kill her before she became lethal to me. The Sibajai is my kryptonite. If turned on me at full force, it shorts me out, renders me helpless. We'd had no idea new royalty were being born. Not a bloody clue. We'd been cut off for too long. I spun, I stabbed, I whirled, I battled. I came back to life in Illyrium, being what I needed to be, doing what I was born to do. Fae after Fae fell beneath my blade. Then Riordan was behind me, and we moved into flawless formation, fighting back to back.
I told you to get the fuck out of here,
he growled over his shoulder. Tell the sun to leave the sky, I growled back.
It does when night moves in. I'm night.
Scientifically untrue. The sun remains, you just don't see it.
We've accomplished our objectives. Retreat.
Not the boss of me.
Bloody hell! Don't I know that? Something's wrong. The bitch is losing Fae left and right and doesn't care. She's waiting for something. I'm pulling the plug. Now.
But it was too late. I'd argued too long. The debilitating, soul-searing burn of the Sibajai slammed into me and charred my insides to useless ash. Jane, I stuttered. He must be here somewhere. Find him. Kill him. That bastard. He wasn't in hiding with his family. He'd been working for the Winter Court, likely offered amnesty if he brought them my sword.
I will. Get out!
Riordan roared. But I couldn't. Nothing was working right. I thudded down into slow-mo and crashed to my knees. Then Riordan had me and was flinging me over his shoulder. Don't touch my left hand, I screamed, rearing up on his back like a cobra, desperate to keep the ungloved, lethal appendage away from him. A prince sifted in directly behind us, blasting me with staggering sexuality, and as he reached for me, I ached to go to him, burned to be his slave, hungered to worship my master. I managed to retain a grip on a single shred of my mind, smiled sweetly at him with utter adoration, and offered him my left hand, silently begging him to seize me from Riordan's shoulder and take me to paradise. Dark, unholy promise burned in his gaze. Blood pooled in mine as I proffered my deadly hand. Take me, I willed. He accepted my submission as his royal due, and reached. As our fingertips met, an explosion of high voltage stabbed up into my head, shot down into my body, and as it flared to lethal life, the Fae Prince exploded into 1,000 fragments of pale white flesh and paler, sharp bone. Bits of him rained down on the club, and as the killing grip of the Sibajai released my mind, I caught a glimpse of Winterborn's pale, incredulous face in the crowd. Then Fae began to scream and trample each other in their haste to escape. I kicked up, launching myself like a rocket from Riordan's shoulder, vaulting high into the air, desperate to get away from him, because the voltage was still arcing and crackling inside me. Off balance, I missed the slipstream entirely, slammed into the floor, rolled and sprang to my feet. Whatever I'd set free inside me wasn't done yet, not nearly exhausted. It was still building. Building, and I had no idea how to control it.
Danny! Get back here!
Riordan roared. I had to do something with it before he grabbed me again, before I sent it shooting into him. I was not killing Riordan. I'd done it twice before and hated it both times. I spun on Winterborn and flung my hand at her. At the precise instant, she thrust 2 pale, slender, icy hands at me. Bolts of lightning exploded from my fingertips, one after the next, shattering her ice-summoned weapons, blasting a path through them as I sent my power gunning for her. Holy hell! She sifted out! I'd missed! Furious, I slammed more bolts into the walls, into the floor. If I couldn't kill her, At least I could obliterate their horrific club from the face of our Earth. I dumped energy from my body in powerful surges of lightning. Then, abruptly, I was sailing in space. Crystal clear and cool, surrounded by an infinity of stars on a nebula painted canvas of black velvet sky. It was vast, but I was enormous. It was ancient, but I was too. It was timeless, but I was without end. There was wind here, gusting, swirling waves of it buffeting my body. It felt as if I might catch one and go shooting up, higher, higher, before channeling the borrowed velocity to dive beneath a moon, perhaps go ricocheting out around a star. I'd always thought space was still, but it wasn't. It was living and flowing, ebbing and changing. Not emptiness here, but some kind of dark matter that defied understanding. The stuff of the cosmos, rife with possibility. As if all the hopes and dreams and desires that had ever been and would ever be were nestled deep within super-dense molecules of darkness we could never comprehend. And every now and then, something came along with wings, or melody, rippled against that dark matter, stirring it up with lightning and song, with bolts of extreme high voltage, changing, waking, beginning something new, stitching things together in ways that defied comprehension, making connections, forging patterns and symmetry from chaos. I felt a great breeze then, and turned whatever head I had into the wind. An enormous black hunter sailed along beside me, head rocking gently as it buffeted the waves, lips pulled back as it chuffed softly and turned its gargantuan head to fix me with a single glowing orange eye.
Ready?
I frowned. For what?
I fly.
I see that.
You fly too.
What was it saying? That I might remain here with it, flying through the greatest unexplored territory of all? Discover the secrets of the cosmos? Behold its ancient mysteries?
All of that and more.
But my people, this wasn't my world. Mine was in danger once more, and probably always would be. My world needed me. I had a job to do. I closed my eyes, willing it all to go away. When I opened them again, I stood blinking repeatedly, blinded by the sudden harsh light. The jarring transition. I was in the club, but things had changed while I drifted in the cosmic vision. The surviving Fae had vanished, sifted, flown, or run away, leaving behind only the dead, the Nine, and me.
Danny.
Raiden's voice seemed to come from a great distance. I blinked again, staring dazedly at the destruction around me. Walls were splintered and crumbling. The floor was cleft by a 50-foot-wide crevice with jagged edges that dropped to a bottomless abyss. The LED panels had been shattered, spraying bits of glass and wiring everywhere. And those people trapped beneath the floor were gone. I shivered, fallen to their deaths down the gorge I'd carved. A small part of my brain said, a better death than the one they were facing. A bigger part said, yet more people you failed to save. The structure of Illyrium groaned, as timbers contorted in a hopeless effort to accommodate the compromised foundation.
Danny,
Raiden said again.
Honey,
I heard Lore say.
Can you hear us?
I nodded tightly.
Put your hand down, Danny,
Raiden said softly, carefully. I hadn't realized it was still raised. I stared at it, turning it this way and that, trying to process it. My left forearm had sprouted darkly beautiful obsidian thorns. It looked like a black velvet studded opera glove. I forced it to drop to my side.
Look at me, Danny,
said Riordan in a low, intense voice. I turned slowly and met his gaze. His eyes flickered strangely, swirling with shadows, and I saw, as clearly as if he'd spoken the words,
God damn, I was right. She isn't human. I knew it.
Then,
shit. This wasn't at all what I expected. Fuck.
The words hadn't come to me in the usual manner of his silent communications, deliberately telegraphed. I'd gotten an entire memory attached to his first thought. Nothing with the second. He hadn't believed I was human since he saw me outside Temple Bar, as I'd stood watching street mimes, laughing my ass off, one hand shoved in my pocket, the other cramming a cheeseburger in my mouth. I'd had two black eyes, and was badly bruised, still drunk on being able to freeze frame all over the city, before I learned to lock my mental grid down. But that wasn't when we'd met. We hadn't met for some time after that. Still, he had a flawlessly detailed memory of walking up behind me, stopping a matter of mere inches from my back, pausing for a moment, inhaling deeply before vanishing in that eerie, instant way of his. If I'd sensed an electrifying presence behind me, I'd written it off as my own excitement at finally being free in the world. He'd known about me long before he came to find me on that water tower, to rope me into working for him. I tried to ponder that thought, but my brain was sluggish and uncooperative. I couldn't access any of my mental vaults. Was this how normal people felt? How terrible that must be. How did they even stand it? I had sludge in my head. My legs went out from under me then. As I slumped to the floor, I cried out to Riordan, "Don't catch me! Don't touch me! I'm dangerous!" Riordan smiled faintly, but it didn't reach his eyes.
I think we've figured that out.
Falling. Belong. Etymology. Old English. Gelong. At hand. Together with. Definition. To be suitable. Advantageous. Appropriate. To have the proper qualifications, especially social. To be a member of a group. To fit. To be attached. Bound by birth, allegiance, or dependency. To be a son, daughter, mother, father, lover. Families belong to each other. I have no idea what the word means. My mam said I belonged in a cage. But I know better. I've never belonged anywhere. Danny O'Malley. 25. What have I become, my sweetest friend? Hey, Shazmataz. I greeted him with a weary cheer as I trudged into my bedroom and flipped on the overhead light. He raised his great shaggy head from the mattress on the floor and peered at me, scanning me intently from head to toe. It was a look we'd often given each other after battle, ascertaining whether the other was okay. His violet eyes widened.
You're thorny,
he exclaimed.
That'll be a trillium scratch.
One of my old passwords used to be thornybitch 314159, a combination of how I sometimes felt, plus the first 6 digits of pi. I considered choosing more wisely in the future. That I am. I assume trillium's good.
The best,
he enthused, but sobered quickly.
Are you all right, Yi-Yi?
He fretted.
It grew again.
I'm fine, I said, slipping out of my dress. I'm going to wash up. Then I need big-time cuddles. Oodles of them.
And we'll put the mattress back up?
You betcha. I headed for the shower. Riordan had dropped me off and left, seething, a few minutes ago. I couldn't help it. I needed to be alone. I'd gotten used to being alone. Something was happening to me, and I wanted time to focus my brain on it. I'd had to rest for 5 solid minutes before I could push up from the floor, leaving the shattered, collapsing club behind. I wasn't about to let anyone pick me up and carry me out. Although I no longer felt the exhilarating, terrifying wild voltage inside me. I was taking no chances. While I'd gathered my strength, Lore had picked through the rubble, searching for my shoes. But they were nowhere to be found. Which pissed me off because I loved those shoes. I'd worn them once. The others had remained in beast form in case the Fae decided to try to circle back for another attack, which I found highly improbable. They'd gone 2 years without a single threat, and we'd just killed 100 of them, if not more. The possibility of death is something Fae avoid like humans avoid Ebola. I wanted to ponder the ramifications of our actions tonight, but at the moment, all I could think about was myself. My confusion had abated, but I was still shaky and weak. Riordan, meticulous planner that he is, had snacks stashed in the Ferrari, and I'd inhaled candy bars one after the other before shoving half a bag of chips in my mouth. I glanced at the mirror and raised a brow, thinking wryly, aha, that's why they were all staring at me like that. Blackness had taken more of my pale Irish skin. Not only was my left arm a thorny black glove, the stain had spread further into my flesh. Exotic black flames arced up the left side of my neck, curving over my jaw, my cheek, to my temple, and into my left brow. The pointed tip of one of those flames ended a mere inch from my mouth. The mouth, it was suddenly acutely aware, it hadn't done nearly enough kissing. The Nine had closed in protectively around me as we walked to the car, which I found hysterically funny, given what I'd just done. Killed a prince without using the sword, destroyed a club. Riordan had argued with me all the way back to Sanctuary, demanding I return to Chester's with him, demanding we talk. Lacking the energy to argue, I'd looked at him and said simply, "Please, I very much need to be alone right now." I know Riordan. Had I argued, he'd have debated me forever. But my quiet plea had taken the bite out of the wolf, and, bristling with barely restrained testosterone and anger, he parked and escorted me to my door, saying tightly,
"If you need me, call. Text. Throw up a bloody bat signal. If I don't hear from you first thing in the morning, I'll be on your fucking doorstep, beating down the door."
Only after I promised had he growlingly conceded to leave. I stepped back and assessed my naked body in the mirror. I like my body. It's strong and lean and suits me. I should be horrified by what was happening to me, but I couldn't help but think I looked kind of beautiful. My entire left arm was covered with lovely dark thorns. I had no idea why I thought they were lovely. But I did. They weren't ugly or scary-looking. They were as gently curved as the thorns on a rose, larger, with slightly blunted tips. I ran my hand over them lightly and shivered. They were cold but extraordinarily sensitive, as if entire clusters of nerve endings were nestled at the tips. The barbs ended just beneath my shoulder, but the inky blackness had seized territory on the left side of my torso as well. From beneath my armpit to my waist, shooting more of those ebony flames across my stomach and breasts. On someone else, I'd have found it wicked cool. An otherworldly tattoo, woman of obsidian fire. On me, although it was stunning, not so much. Unless it went away, I would never again feel a man's hands touch my breasts. Unless it went away, I would never again taste Riordan's kiss. Faces touch when you kiss. There was no way a man could get near my mouth with more than a chaste peck, and I'm not a chaste peck kind of woman, as I'd amply demonstrated this morning. God, that felt like a lifetime ago. I'd have kissed him harder, longer, better, if I'd known this was going to happen by nightfall. I forced my thoughts to focus, turned from the mirror and began to tally what I knew. Fact. I stabbed a hunter when I was 14, and my hand turned black for days. Fact. It kept happening over the years. Fact. I'd recently developed an extraordinary superpower, the ability to shoot highly destructive bolts of lightning from my hand, capable of blowing structures apart and killing Fey royalty. I smirked a little. Ha! Take that, the nine. I'm as badass as you. Fact. Each time I used the power, more of me turned black and icy. I frowned. Inaccurate. The blackness hadn't expanded when I killed Bridget, nor when I used it to break the paralysis spell. Or had it? Just not where I could see it. Staining deeper beneath my skin, opposed to wider. Were my bones black now? Fact. When I used the power, it drained me to a degree that appeared to be increasing with use. Or perhaps with the magnitude of use. Fact. If anyone touched the black part of me, they would die. I would kill them. Poison ivy much, I muttered. That wasn't who I planned to be when I grew up. She was Batman's nemesis. I was supposed to be the Bat. Only with superpowers. Fact. If I kept using those incredible lightning bolts, it seemed highly probable I would turn entirely black. I wondered if it would affect my hair, too. Would my eyes turn black? I tried to envision myself all black. Pretty odd. I stepped into the shower and stood under the spray, pondering whether, as Shazam had suggested, I might be able to make it go away. Maybe if I never used it again, the stain would retreat and I'd return to normal. It had retreated once early on, to beneath my elbow. Was it cumulative somehow? Was its mysterious endgame inevitable and irreversible once it had begun? I toweled my hair dry, tugged on sweats and a tee, grateful Shazam was impervious. At least I had that. Assuming I survived whatever was happening to me, I was going to become that strange Hellcat lady, eccentric and alone. It could be worse, I mused, as I headed back to the bedroom. I might not even have Shazam. I, who at best had never known more than a tenuous connection to the world, was becoming even more cut off, more isolated, by my own skin. I'd always been dangerous, now I was lethal to the touch. My first year in a cage, my mother had showered me with affection, before she'd left in the morning and again each night when she got home. She'd washed and dried me, brushed my hair. We'd held hands through the bars. She'd rubbed moisturizer into my skin and tickled my back, and I'd known we were going to make it. That older and outside were a guarantee. I'd known it from her touch. You can feel love in someone's hands. It hadn't stayed that way long. Her affection became more and more infrequent. Until, finally, she'd stopped touching me at all. Then, not long after, she'd begun to stop seeing me too. When I could no longer remember the feel of her hands on my body, my hair, of soft kisses pressed through bars, when those kisses had become a hazy memory that belonged to another life, some other child, I'd lain in my cage and hugged myself, turning my head from side to side, kissing my shoulders, my arms. My small body had ached for touch, for comfort, for love, as it did now. I hoisted our mattress back up onto the box springs, stretched out on my back, and opened my arms. Shazam flung himself at me, landing squarely on my chest. Ow! Rumbling, eyes gleaming, he headbutted me with delight, then snuggled into my killing embrace. And, as I'd done so often Silverside, I squeezed my eyes shut to hold back tears and held on to him with all my might. 26. The rusted chains of prison moons are shattered by the sun.
First cut,
Christian said.
A summary of pertinent history. Try to hold your questions till the end. The timeline I'm giving you is approximate. The Fae aren't glued to the concept of time. They have an affinity of it to squander. I had to plug bits and pieces of history together with few points of reference.
Understood, I said. We encountered the same problem with the texts we'd translated. Points of reference were vague at best, like tying our historical events to whatever TV shows were popular at the time, and someone trying to figure it out millennia later. If he possessed an overview, I very much wanted it.
The first significant mention of the Fae appears approximately 1 million years ago, although they existed long before that. Originally, there was a single light court of four seasons. The Light King became dissatisfied with life at court, left and declared himself the Dark or Unseelie King. Sometime after that, he met his mortal concubine, became obsessed with her and sought to make her immortal like him. Since the Song of Making was a matriarchal power, he had to petition the Light Queen to transform his lover. It was when the Queen refused that everything began to go to hell. The Unseelie King retired to his dark kingdom, vowing to recreate the song and make his lover immortal himself. The Unseelie or Dark Court was born as a result of his endless experiments. As far as I can tell, he spent roughly a quarter of 1 million years working on it. Again, approximate, I believe Cruz was born 750,000 years ago, and was one of the last remaining Dark Court the King created. As you know, Cruz betrayed the King to the Queen and told her what the King had been doing, about 500,000 years ago. Cruz wanted the Unseelie Court to roam freely in the world, mingling with the Seelie, which was forbidden by the King. The King knew what the Queen would do if she discovered he'd created a dark court of his own, especially if she learned that the mortal lover she so despised was still alive, secreted away in a realm beyond time to keep her from aging. When the Queen learned of the dark court's existence, it started a war to end all wars. When Seelie and Unseelie clashed, they destroyed their own planet, splitting it down the middle. The unthinkable happened. The Unseelie King killed the Seelie Queen before she was able to pass the Song of Making to her successor. The song was all that kept the Fae powerful. They alone possessed that ancient melody of life.
No doubt stolen somehow, I said, unable to resist the acerbic comment. No god I believed in would have entrusted a thing of such power and beauty to such a shallow, power-hungry, ruthless race.
As you've seen, the song seeps into reality and replenishes fading magic. Once they lost the ancient melody, the Fae were doomed. Over time, they would have grown weaker until they vanished on the wind, with only legends of them remaining.
But when Mac used the song to heal our world, they were restored, I said grimly.
Precisely. What the melody didn't destroy, it made stronger. As happened long ago in the mists of time, the song sank deep into the fabric of all things and crooned Awaken. Another of Mac's double-edged swords. That woman does tend to wreak havoc from time to time.
I began to protest, but he waved it away.
I ken it, lass. She had no choice but to use the song, or the cosmos itself would have been destroyed by the black holes. We're lucky she was able to wield it, and I'm grateful. But no action is without consequence. Indeed, there are times the most desirable, correct, necessary action results in catastrophic consequences. We're facing them now. Back to the timeline. Subsequent queens moved the Light Court from world to world, draining yet more power from the court each time they moved, desperately seeking a planet richly steeped in magic. They knew they were diminishing bit by bit. Many of them drank from the cauldron of forgetting, to forget how powerful they'd once been, how weak they were becoming. Eventually, around 200,000 years ago, they discovered our world, which still pulsed with considerable magic. But it was already occupied by both gods and ancient man. It was a peaceful time on our planet before the Fae arrived. The gods were mostly benign, and although they occasionally warred among themselves, they cared for and tended the mortals who worshipped them, and there was a strong bond between them. The Fae, deceitful bastards that they are, feigned far less power than they had, and begged sanctuary from the gods, claiming their world had been destroyed through no fault of their own. The gods, sensing no threat, gave the Fae a fair amount of land, and things were peaceful for a time. But the Fae were busy gathering intelligence, desperate to seize and rule our magic-rich world. They covertly studied the gods, seeking weaknesses. Their attack was patient, stealthy, and a shining example of slanted press on a global scale. They abducted the gods one by one, used their fey glamour to impersonate them, and began punishing, torturing, and killing humans. To humans, it seemed their gods had turned on them. In kind, humans turned on their gods, and the gods that remained turned on their humans for betraying them, for refusing to listen when they tried to explain what the Fae had done. Then, the great, benevolent Fae finally stepped in to rescue humans. The gods realized the Fae had been concealing their true power all along, but gods can't penetrate the glamour of the Fae, and the Fae gathered up and killed most of the deities on our world, leaving a scattered handful of those too powerful to kill, or those who devised ways to elude their clutches. I've no idea how many remain, but I'd wager a few hundred or so. Those gods they couldn't figure out how to kill. Unlike Fae, all gods can't be killed by two commonly known weapons. Each has one unique way they can die, and it's a tightly guarded secret. They captured and entombed them in the earth. They relinquished one of their most powerful Sheans, or Fae mounds, to use as a prison. For a long time the gods slumbered in the soil, faded to mere wisps of their former selves. But when the ancient song was sung again, it awakened and released them from those tombs. The gods had learned from their mistakes. They came back weak, as mere shadows, and bided time as stealthily as the Fae once had, laying low, absorbing power from the newly reinvigorated earth, until they were once again powerful. Only recently have they begun to show themselves.
I murmured, and they despise the Fae more than ever and plot their destruction.
Worse than that, Cat. They despise humans, too. They loathe both races and want both gone, and the odds aren't quite so against them now. The first time the gods and Fae battled, Sheseers didn't exist. The Fae weren't on our world, and there was no need for them. But now they do exist, and the gods have an enormous advantage they once lacked. Before, they couldn't have seen a Fae standing right next to them if it was glamoured as a human. With Sheseer watchdogs, they can.
I shuddered. Was that where our 12 She-Seers had gone? Abducted by gods? I knew better than to assure him that our She-Seers wouldn't help them. Dole out enough torture. Eventually someone will cooperate. Have you discovered when our order was born? Our roots were a mystery to us. I was fascinated by our origins. I knew the why of it. To protect the She-Sadu.
Aye. Again, approximately. As you know, after the Unseelie King killed the Queen, Cruz stole his beloved concubine and made the King believe she was dead. In an act of atonement, the King dumped all the formidable power of his dark magic into the Shisadu and cast it out into the world. But as Fae things do, it evolved, and furious with the King, obsessed with him, the dark doppelganger began to stalk the Unseelie King, wreaking havoc wherever it went. The two played a game of cat and mouse for hundreds of thousands of years.
Wait a minute. I have to ask this. We were led to believe the Shisadu was nearly a million years old. It's only a half a million.
Depends on how you look at it. The Shisadu is commonly regarded as a million years old because it contains the Unseelie King's knowledge from the time he began creating his dark court, nearly a million years ago, until the time he divested himself of it, over half a million years later. Technically, It is only 500,000 years old. Again, this is all only approximate.
I nodded. Go on.
When the king finally managed to capture his dangerous alter ego, roughly 150,000 years ago, he needed a secure place to contain it with guards. Conveniently, there already existed a Sheehan on a planet, rich in magic, laced with the proper elements, the perfect place to entomb it, a place the Seelie would never go because they'd already buried their ancient enemy there and abandoned it.
I gasped. Are you kidding me? Are you saying? I trailed off in disbelief. He caught me a dark smile.
Aye. The Unseelie King paid a visit to our world and hid the Shisadu beneath what is now Arlington Abbey, above the entombed gods, then created the She-Seers as his final Unseelie caste to serve as his watchdogs. He gave your order the power to penetrate Fey glamour, the ability to ward your land against Fey, and various gifts to fight them if they came.
I shook my head, dazed by the thought. The gods have been slumbering beneath our abbey this entire time.
Oh, lass, from the hints I've gathered here and there, your abbey perches atop many powerful things. I'd like to explore the underneath if you'd permit it. Soon. We've a mess on our hands and require every advantage we can find.
I nodded. We would find a way to work together.
Back to the timeline. The war between gods and fae had ravaged the earth. Queen of Eel, who had once been mortal herself, had watched too many planets destroyed. Eventually, and I can't pin that event to a time, she forcibly removed the fae to a separate realm, fabricating walls by tapping into the power of the Unseelie prison walls, striking a compact with a clan called the Kelter, and trained them as druids to uphold it. Here's where it gets complicated. I'm going to try to explain the realm of fairy to you in a nutshell. Under the first queen and Seelie king, fairy consisted of only the Seelie court, a vast, resplendent land with four distinct kingdoms, with royal houses governing each, spring, summer, autumn, and winter. Over them all, the queen ruled. When the king left the Seelie queen and became Unseelie, he expanded fairy to hold the enormity of his own domain. Within his kingdom, he constructed the nearly infinite White Mansion and tied it to the truly infinite Hall of All Days. He also fabricated the Silvers as a secondary means of travel, initially for his and his concubine's use only. Fairy grew from a single court to an enormous tapestry of connected worlds. Some say the battle we wage here on Earth between mortal and fae is happening on countless other worlds with countless other fae courts connected by this network in a multiplicity of universes.
He saw the look on my face and laughed.
Aye, the thought boggles my mind too. Eventually, the Silvers were cursed and the terrain of fairy became even more complex, as if it wasn't already enough of a mess. But for simplicity, think of fairy as the light court and the dark court, the Hall of Days, the Silvers, and the White Mansion all in one enormous, otherworldly realm. But it's no longer otherworldly. No walls divide us. It exists adjacent to, spilling into our own.
Which was why we desperately needed Mac to figure out how to use her power as Fae Queen, so she could sing those walls back up and restore our world to its normal order without Fae preying on humans. How do you know all this? I asked. This was the kind of history we'd long been seeking.
I sent my clan into the White Mansion, to the king's true library, and had them bring me every book and object of interest they could find. The castle, as you'll soon see, is stuffed with books and bottles and potions and endless artifacts that we've transported to Driacht Keep. Heed me well. Touch none of it. They're not your usual books and bottles and such. Danny can tell you a thing or two about what might be found in the king's collection.
He laughed.
Ask her about the Bora Bora books. But don't ask her about the Crimson Hag. And no matter what you do, once you arrive at my castle, bloody hell, don't open any bottles you might see lying around.
If they're so dangerous, why did you bring them out into our world?
Many might prove useful. Knowledge is power. So is power,
he said dryly.
A controllable Crimson Hag would be a hell of an advantage. I don't sleep, Cat. I study. I learn about myself, about the Fae race. I prepare. The gods and Fae are going to war again, and that battle could well destroy our world. The gods want humans eradicated. The Fae want humans enslaved. It's a lose-lose for us either way.
I said, what does this have to do with Sean? I'm assuming it ties in somehow.
We, too, were made dramatically more powerful by the ancient melody. It was months before the full transformation occurred for me, and yet another few months after that for Sean. I suspect it's moved slowly for the Seely as well. We all change at our own unique pace. I've learned to control what I've become. But Sean, alas, your Sean has not, and he must. He's running out of time.
We arrived at the perimeter of Christian's heavily warded kingdom just before dawn. He'd carved apart 50,000 acres of the highlands for his own, and begun repairing and fortifying the enormous ancient castle he'd christened Dreacht Keep. It was in that great, sprawling castle he and Sean lived, in the finished parts of the crumbling ruin. As we soared over a final ben, Christian said,
Brace yourself, lass. It's not pretty.
Even prepared, I was stunned by the vision that greeted us as we cleared that final ben, broke through clouds and soared over his kingdom. Everywhere I looked, the earth was black. Gone was the lush greenery, the abundant profusion of foliage and life. Beneath an endless bank of low-hanging, dense, rumbling thunderclouds that stretched as far as my eye could see, a churning, crashing, dark grey roof, the earth was burnt and barren, as if it had been charred to a crisp. "What happened here, Christian?" I gasped, clinging more tightly to his shoulders as an icy gust blasted me. It was uncommonly cold, too. The temperature had plummeted 30 to 40 degrees the moment we crossed the harsh line of demarcation.
Months after the song was sung, I took a flight through the highlands, savoring the beauty. I'd only just begun to embrace my wings. I was in a buoyant mood that day and decided to take a stroll, visit our local pub for a wee dram before returning to Castle Kelter. I walked the last few miles, enjoying an unusual gentle hum I felt in the earth. It seemed to be seeping up through the soles of my boots, into my skin, deep into my bones. It felt good, Cat. A beautiful rhythmic vibration enlivening me. I didn't understand what was happening. Didn't realize a dormant part of me was responding to the new magic in the earth, awakening. That I was becoming the Prince of Death, who'd once existed 750,000 years ago. When I strolled into the Cock and Crown that day, 142 people, my people, under Kelter care, exploded into clouds of black dust before my eyes. I killed every single person in that pub, merely by entering it. Had I returned home instead of going for a drink, I'd have killed my entire clan, with the sole exception of Dagus.
I flinched. I'm so sorry.
I've spent the past 2 years scouring tomes from the King's Library, seeking information about what I am, what power I have, and how to use it. It's not as if I have anyone to ask. The Seely would prefer us dead. Barring that, they want us on their very short leash to be used as weapons. There are no Unseelie left to educate me.
But don't you sort of just know what you can do? My gift was simple. It slammed me in the face every day. Since the song was sung, it had grown even more potent. But thanks to time spent with Castello, I'd learn how to make and hold walls, Kevlar myself in emotional armor. Before I slept each night, I deliberately and carefully walled the world out, creating a blessed fortress of silence for myself, so I might face the next day rejuvenated, strong.
Not until I try,
Christian said.
And often I'm not trying to do anything at all. The power manifests without my consent, like the day I strolled into the pub. Shortly after I imprisoned myself here, your Sean joined me. He's famine. Wherever he walks, the earth dies. Crops wither. The soil goes barren. In time enough, the world would starve. The same thing happened to him that occurred with me. He felt something seeping up from the soil, and as he walked, the earth around him began to die. Unlike me, he hasn't been able to contain that power.
I winced. It was Sean who destroyed this land?
Aye. He tests himself, strolls out to a strip of what blanched green remains when he thinks he's ready to try again. Each time he destroys the earth, he returns angrier, grows more bitter. Anger and bitterness aren't emotions an unseelie prince can indulge without catastrophic results.
What is that? Who lives there? I exclaimed. He'd soared us far to the north as we'd talked, and we now glided directly above the line of demarcation where the perimeter of his blackened kingdom met lush green again. I'd seen something like it before, the abrupt transition where the shades had devoured everything in sight, as they'd approached our abbey, but had stopped for reasons unknown. On the charred land to my right stood a small, fat-roofed crofter's cottage in the midst of lifeless earth. On the grassy side, directly adjacent to it, was another small crofter's cottage of stone that was welcoming and warm, surrounded by neatly tended gardens where flowers bloomed. The cottages were day and night. Yin and Yang huddled next to each other. Far below us, a couple walked on the grassy side, near the cottage holding hands.
That's Dagus and Chloe. He lives within my wards. She lives just beyond them. I've warded the fuck out of her cottage too, but will not permit her inside my kingdom, lest we inadvertently harm her.
You came into our abbey, yet killed no one. I felt you, Christian. You have it under control.
There is no ward, no charm, no magic solution to harnessing a prince's deadly powers. What I use to master it is the simplest yet often the most elusive thing of all. Love. If I grow angry, if I allow myself any negative emotion at all, I can slip.
He said quietly.
The key to success is never being bitter, never being angry. Never coveting, never succumbing to any kind of desire that contains darkness. Your Sean, lass, he's consumed by it.
I blinked back a swift burn of tears. I'd wondered, so many nights in my private garden of silence at the end of each day, where my childhood love had gone, why he'd never texted or called. He'd simply walked away, without another word. It had pained me, almost beyond enduring. Yet all this time, Sean had been holed up in isolation, warded away from the world, trying to learn to control the unseelie monster he'd become. All this time, I'd thought he'd left me because he didn't want me, didn't want us. And so I'd given him his privacy. I'd not texted or called either. Stung, hurt. McLaughlin stubborn and unyielding. But that wasn't why he'd left at all. Sometimes, despite the open window I have into everyone else's emotions, I can be blind and foolish about my own. Take me to him, Christian.
I hoped you'd say that.
27. Crawling in my skin. These wounds, they will not heal. I lost one of my birds this morning. His name was Charles James Aubrey. He was 23. He hung himself in my flat on DeSoto after only 9 days off the streets. I just dropped in on him 3 days ago, and even I'd been fooled. But I've seen many come and go, and I've learned a bit about their ways. Sometimes, right before they check out, they seem better than ever, well-adjusted. Not giddy or tip-you-off kind of happy, but misleadingly balanced. And I wonder about that borrowed grace. Wonder about the enormous amount of pain they must be suffering to finally feel okay only when they decide to opt out of this crazy, beautiful world. You don't see it coming. Not even me. Although, I've learned to watch for an unexpected, suspicious peace. He left a note.
I didn't ask to be born.
I wish I had more time. I have a theory about depression. I think it comes from a shift in the chemicals in our brains, because stress, trauma, and grief deplete our happy juice, disrupt the delicate, necessary balance, and make the world go flat around us, get scary and monochrome, too heavy to bear. And once you're there, with depleted brain chemicals and flat colours, you're too depressed to fight your way out. I think exercise is a way to increase endorphins, rebalance the brain, and I wonder if my extreme velocity and constant motion feed my brain undiluted happy juice, constantly perking me up. I wonder if I figured out, say, the right blend of cortisol, 5-HTP and Bacopa, maybe a few other nootropics plus lots of fun physical activity and loads of kindness and sunshine, then gave those people one happy, stress-free year without any responsibility, maybe I could turn their world around. I cut him down and held him. He was still warm. I may have missed him by an hour. He must have died shortly after dawn, lingered to watch one more sunrise. If so, that slayed me, because it meant he still had joy somewhere inside. If only someone had been able to reach and nurture it. I wrapped him in a blanket and took him to a cemetery I use for the lost ones. I don't have a lot of time, but I always bury them. And I always do something for them. Dublin goes dispassionately on. This beautiful, terrifying, packed with limitless possibility and peril chronic town, chug-a-chugs on, a locomotive barreling down the tracks, with neither deviation in schedule nor pause for fallen. They vanish, unnoticed, unsung. I blow the horn for them, yank that cable down and let her rip. I graffitied his name on an underpass in 3 vibrant shades of neon, 10 feet tall, telling the world that Charles James Aubrey was here. It may have been brief, but by God, he was here and will be remembered. If only by me. He couldn't stand the pain, and I couldn't save him from it. I went straight to Chester's after painting the underpass, and dashed up the stairs to Riordan's office when I didn't find him below with the workers. I'd texted earlier, telling him I was fine and I'd be by around 10. He's not a man you don't text when he tells you to. He'll come looking for you, and he'll be pissed. I wasn't in the mood to repair my door again. I still had to fix the elevator, and I hadn't vacuumed in weeks. Shazam hair was everywhere. When the darkened glass panel whisked silently aside, I stalked across the glass floor that always makes me feel suspended in space, flung myself into the chair in front of his desk, kicked my feet over the side, and told him what I'd decided late last night, or rather near dawn this morning, with neither preface nor preamble. I think I'm becoming a hunter. I leaned back and waited for him to deny it. I didn't actually think it myself. It was absurdly far-fetched. I was, however, quite certain I would turn completely black at some point. Still, the vision I'd had at the club last night seemed like, I don't know, an invitation of sorts. And I wanted to bounce my worst-case scenario off someone who would laugh and tell me that was ridiculous. I wasn't turning into one of those icy black demons with eyes like gates to hell, no matter how benign it had appeared in my vision, sailing along next to me. To hear him say he knew a spell, a ward, or a charm that would make my deadly skin go away because, by God, Riordan knew everything. Criminy, he was beautiful this morning. Tall and dark, freshly showered and shaved, smelling good. Looking powerful and ridiculous behind that stuffy desk. He belongs on a battlefield, like me. He said flatly.
You think?
I stiffened. That wasn't the right answer. Riordan's version of duh. What do you mean, duh? You didn't even know I'd stabbed a hunter. He leaned back in his chair and folded his arms behind his head. The sleeves of his shirt were rolled up to his elbows, his forearms strong, scarred, silver cuff glinting. I know Riordan well. The fine muscles in his face were too tight. He was pissed about something. Extremely.
I knew you stabbed the hunter. I read every paper you wrote. And your book. All editions. Your footnotes needed work. I didn't, however.
He growled.
No, your bloody hand turned black afterward. You neglected to mention that.
It was no one's business but mine. And how do you know it now? And why was he taking this so seriously? I just told him I thought I was turning into one of those enormous dragons Jane used to shoot at all the time, and I used to try to kill, species unknown, and he'd said only, "You think?" It was an absurd theory. I was small. Hunters were enormous. If nothing else, I lacked sufficient mass.
Cat told me that part.
Cat? I said disbelievingly. When? What do you guys do? Sit around and talk about me or something?
This morning when I texted her.
He said tightly.
I told her you were turning black and she knew all about it. Lore wasn't watching you every moment. He did the best he could. Christian was supposed to relieve him sometimes, and he's still not fucking returning my calls. Do you know how infuriating it is to have to find out the details of your life from someone else?
Do you know how infuriating it is to not even be able to find out the details of your life? I countered just as irritably. At least you can butt in and text my friends. I don't have Lore's number, or Casteo's, or Fade's. I said, working myself into a snit. And if I did, I continued, eyes flashing, you'd have told them not to tell me a bloody thing, just to keep me wandering around, forever stymied by the great big mystery of RK bloody the fuck S. And just what the hell do the K and S stand for, anyway?
Killian. St. James.
Huh? Riordan just told me his name? I rolled it silently over my tongue. Riordan Killian St. James. I liked it. It was polished, urbane as the man he pretended to be. Killian was like killing, sharp-edged and intriguing. St. James was lofty, old money, blue blood and power. Oh, now that's just a pile of bull, I said crossly. That's so bloody Irish and you're not. How could you possibly have an Irish name? It wasn't even close to anything I'd ever come up with, and that made me even madder. I did something then so incredibly bizarre and plebeian and juvenile that I couldn't even wrap my brain around it. I thought, Danny Killian St. James. It had a nice ring to it. Wait, what?
It wasn't my first,
he said,
though the initials are the same. It's the one I took when I made my home here. We changed our names to fit the clime, the time. I've kept that one a while.
So you talked to Kat. She told you my hand turned black, and from that mere fact alone, you deduced I was turning into a hunter? At least I'd had the vision to go on, the ready, you fly too. Although I couldn't decide if it implied I would actually physically transform into a hunter, or just turn completely black, become lethal to the touch, yet receive the small consolation prize of being able to astral project into the stars on occasion. Superhero rules are pretty obscure. He inclined his head in one of those imperious nods. Some people might have thought it had infected me, and I was dying, I told him. I'd briefly entertained the notion myself. It hadn't resonated in my gut, and although I prize my brain, I value my gut just as highly. A lot of times more.
I'm not some people.
You're not even people.
There is that. Are you so sure you are?
I shot him a sharp look. You don't think I am. And why didn't I know you met me before I thought we met? His gaze shuddered. You wanted rules? Fine, I'm making one. One of ours, which means we both obey it. Full disclosure, or don't bloody well interfere in my life. Don't even try to be a part of it. Don't you think? I threw his own words back at him. It's time we cut everything loose. I might be gone soon, soaring around in space, a hunter. You might never see me again. I bet then you'll be sorry you didn't talk to me. I didn't say, I bet then you'll be sorry you went away for 2 years and wasted them. But I wanted to. Except people have to want to stay with you, and he clearly hadn't. He jerked and snarled.
I'll bloody well be sorry I didn't do more than that with you, Danny. I wanted to make love to you. I wanted to fuck you. I wanted to cut loose with you like I've never been able to cut loose with a woman in my entire existence. I wanted to explore every ounce of that brilliant mind and every inch of that powerful body of yours. Learn your deepest desires. Be the one to rock your goddamn world. Watch the great Danny O'Malley abandon herself to passion. See her in one place she's never conflicted and revel in being alive.
Holy hell, he felt it too.
The nine have no equals,
he said, eyes glittering with crimson fire.
We always hold back, an eternity of being careful. It's not our nature to be restrained, especially not when we fuck.
I'd never thought about it that way. Like me, he could break people without even meaning to. Restrained sex. Oxymoron any way you looked at it. To have so much inside ya, all coiled up and ready to explode, waiting, always waiting for someone to come along who can see it, who can handle it, and never being able to let it out? I know what it feels like. Pain. A pain that, unlike the others I've mastered, I've never been able to figure out how to stop feeling. I don't know that you can. It's life, trying to happen.
A woman like you is a once-in-an-eternity opportunity. Every bloody one of us was waiting to see what you'd become when you grew up. I told you, you're a fucking tsunami. I knew it even then. You didn't smell like other people.
The nine had been watching me, waiting to see what kind of woman I'd become.
And Christ, you ran on pure adrenaline, unchecked aggression and sky-fucking-high dreams. The most fearless thing I'd ever seen. God damn it, Danny. Everything I've done since the day I met you has been about keeping you alive. To never cage you or take away your choices. To see you rise, watch you become.
What? A bloody hunter? I demanded.
I had no fucking idea that might happen.
He snarled.
If I'd known your hand had turned black, I would have factored that into my linchpin theories about you and drawn conclusions sooner. It might have affected my actions, changed them. You withheld a critical piece of information.
He was angry about it, and not even trying to hide it. His face no longer cool and composed, but savage, fangs distending. As if you don't all the time, I flung, on the verge of vibrating, melting into the slipstream without even meaning to. Papers on his desk gusted, his hair ruffled.
Breathe,
he ordered.
Get control of yourself.
Practice the preach. Your fangs are showing. But I closed my eyes and took a moment to center myself. Then my eyes flew open and I said, What the hell, Riordan? What if I actually become a hunter? My voice broke on the last word, pain lacing it. Was I just one of those people who never got to belong? In this world, but not of it? Never, ever, once, really, of it? He was silent a long moment, as if trying to decide what to say. A muscle worked in his jaw. Finally, he said carefully.
If you become a hunter, perhaps you won't care about this world, or those of us in it anymore. Perhaps it's what you're meant to be. Your journey takes you somewhere else.
You don't believe in fate, I rejected flatly. You believe in you.
Ah, Stardust. I've seen too many patterns unfold during my existence that hold a startling, cohesive symmetry. There's a plan, and it's way the fuck bigger than you and me. The universe has an agenda. For a long time, everything I did was in defiance of it. Then, I began trying to protect that agenda, so I could at least have some small say in the details.
I said irritably, I'd miss you, and I definitely still care about our world. I love our world. It's always my second priority. Survival is first.
I'd like to believe that. But maybe some people are destined for larger things. And, according to you, you didn't miss me at all for the past 2 years. I hardly see you missing me now, if you become something even less human.
Perhaps it's not inevitable. Perhaps I can make it go away. I ignored his other comments. I still didn't know where he'd gone or why, and I was never telling him a single thing I missed about him until he told me that.
Perhaps. Time will tell. In the meantime, once again, we've got a world to save. Perhaps we'll need a hunter to save it.
Perhaps, I countered, we'll only need a little bit of a hunter's power, and perhaps I can turn it off once we fix things and be normal again.
Again implies you once were that way. You weren't. And there's nothing in this world you'd hate more than being normal.
He was right about that. What would you do if you were me?
I'd keep an open mind. Consider all possibilities. That's all any of us can do. Life is a box you don't get to open all at once. You can touch it, pick it up, shake it even, but you can only guess at the contents. There's a hole in the top of the box where things come out, on their own timetable, on their own terms. You think you have things figured out,
he said with a note of bitterness in his voice.
Only to find you saw everything completely wrong, didn't understand a bloody bit of it. So you wait to see what pops out next, and you go on living in the meantime.
Sound advice. Pretty much what I'd concluded, without the box metaphor. What's on the agenda today, boss?
Riordan. Let's just be you and me for a while. No role-playing, no superheroes. Just a man and a woman who admire each other and drive each other bugfuck crazy. Spending time together. Let's make that rule number two.
What's rule number one? And who gets to make it? I demanded. He met my gaze and held it a long moment. Behind those remote silver eyes, storms rushed and swirled. Immense, thunderous storms. He was upset. That worried me. One of my rules goes something like this. If an unseelie prince says run, run. Another is, if Riordan looks upset, be afraid. Be very, very afraid. But me and him, we don't do fear. We plunge back into our worlds and wait for the next thing to pop out of the box, prepared to face it.
I'll leave that one up to you,
he said finally.
You get to decide our number one rule.
His gaze added,
make it a good one. I'll never break it.
We exchanged a smile then, unlike any we'd shared before, an unguarded expression of warmth and respect. Unfortunately, it did nothing at all to chase away the storms from either of our eyes. 28. A momentary lapse of reason that binds a life for life. Christian's castle was atmospheric, to say the least. It sprawled atop a high cliff, towering over the vales below, affording a clear view of potential invaders. Though it was morning, Not one speck of sunlight penetrated the bank of gloomy thunderclouds overhead. That smothering, low-hanging ceiling of slate stretched from horizon to horizon, as far as the eye could see. The only illumination was one lightning that sizzled and crackled high above, causing the clouds to briefly flicker a slightly paler shade of depression. The castle was vast, rambling across a mighty bluff, dropping sharply away on three sides. On the fourth, the wild crashing sea slammed into the base of the towering dark bluff. The only way in was a winding path gouged into the side of the cliff. Once one topped that path, a long road with stone walls on each side led to a perimeter stone wall that enclosed the entire estate, broken only by a mighty drawbridge that was up and heavily barred. Then the winding streets of the keep proper began. Tall stone towers stretched up into the dense grey ceiling, vanishing within. The castle soared and ducked, towered, then slumped to low garrison-like buildings. A full two-thirds of it was crumbling, yielding to the passage of time. The remaining third had been restored. The ocean frothed and foamed beyond it, crashing into rocks far below. The entire estate was a study in angry slates, broody greys, and dark, tension-filled shadows, broken only by that one intermittent lightning flickering high above. We landed atop a low turret, and I moved away from him, hugging myself to stay warm, my hair whipping about my head in the wild, salty breeze. "Why is it so cold and gloomy here?" I had to speak loudly to be heard over the wind. "Is it because of you?"
"Sean, we affect the climate with our mood. His mood has been foul for a long time. The sun hasn't shone on my keep since a few weeks after his arrival. What grass remains for him to test himself on is pale and sparse. He said last week if he runs out of grass within my kingdom, he's leaving."
I sucked in a sharp breath. "To go where?" Christian shrugged.
"I've no idea, lass, and he wouldn't say. He's not speaking to me right now. Perhaps into Faerie, or the Unseelie Kingdom, perhaps into Silvers and beyond. We can't lose him. We have to get him back somehow."
As my teeth began to chatter from the cold, he said,
"But let's get you inside, lass. It's warm within. I'll see you fed and set you on the path to Sean."
I shivered as I picked my way up crumbling, dusty stone stairs. During a hasty meal of cheese and bread, Christian had told me a bit more about Sean, concluding with directions on how to find him. He felt it best I approach alone, as Sean could feel Christian as he drew near, and grew even angrier.
"Then the bloody clouds consume the entire castle."
"Inside and out," he'd told me.
"Is not pleasant."
As I'd wandered the eccentric keep, crammed with towering stacks of ancient books and manuscripts, chests and bottles, Raiden had texted repeatedly, and I texted back, answering his questions about Danny, wanting desperately to call him and find out what was going on. But I had my own battle here, and from what Christian had told me, it was going to be a difficult, if not terrifying, one. I paused to catch my breath before topping the last few rounds of the spiraling stone staircase. Sean had retreated to the ruined part of the castle, the far tower where, Christian told me, he was wont to loom, a brooding dark shadow, staring out over the sea. Unlike the rest of the castle, which Christian kept toasty warm somehow, it was freezing here. I tugged the woolen throw Christian had given me more snugly around my shoulders as I finished my climb.